Hello, I am Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. The Center for Women's and Gender Studies was founded here at UBC in 1991. The center is a hub for a wide network of faculty and research associates who are engaged in interdisciplinary feminist projects, profiling feminist work throughout the campus and across British Columbia, Canada, and globally to ensure that UBC is better known for its record of feminist initiatives and that the UBC community can better understand the diverse needs and resources pertinent to feminist scholarship. On Prof Talk today, I have the pleasure of having Dr. Sanira Tobani on the show. She's an associate professor in the Center for Women's and Gender Studies, but also the director of RAGA, the Center for Race, Autobiography, Gender, and Age. Dr. Tobani's current research projects focuses on gender, race, globalization, and media representations of the war on terror. Sanira Tobani joins me now in the CITR studio. Thank you, Sanira, for coming in today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, the Center for Women's and Gender Studies at UBC is 20 years old this year. In your mind, what are the most important achievements of the center during these past two decades, and what work still needs to be done?
Well, we've really put women's studies on the map here at UBC. We have a thriving program, and, you know, it's an interdisciplinary program. And, you know, our center, small though it is, actually has produced immense resources that have reached out beyond the UBC community. So our faculty have produced, you know, groundbreaking works, books based on their research. Our teaching program, I think, is one of the best in the country. And we became actually the second university in Canada to offer a PhD in women's studies. So we have a good, strong, proud record. And, you know, even though our achievements have been much, we still have challenges, and the challenges are, you know, faced by women's studies programs on other campuses as well. And that is a kind of constant lack of resources. You know, we could be doing a lot more if we had more resources.
So because women's studies is so interdisciplinary, how does your department connect with other units on campus? How does it really sort of work in terms of gender studies, you know, crossing over to other disciplines?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of our faculty are cross-appointed. So they have another department in which they are based, as well as women's studies. And so there's that link with the other departments. We also have faculty associates across the university, and they come from all disciplines, sciences, humanities, social sciences. And, you know, they are also part of the women's studies committee, community here on campus. We also have courses that are cross-listed with other departments. And in the classes, even the women's studies classes that I teach, for example, which is not cross-listed, the majority of the students I have in my class this term, which is gender, globalization, and international politics, the majority of the students are from outside women's studies.
That's fabulous. Now, so when a course is taught, so you're teaching women's studies at the moment, how do students find out about your courses beyond what's in the course schedule? Does the Women's Studies Center, does it branch out in terms of its publicity?
Yes, we do branch out. So we have a very strong listserv, and we send out announcements about, you know, our activities, courses. Word of mouth, I find, is also really important. And, you know, most of the students I get, for example, have heard from somebody else about my classes, and they say, oh, you got to take a class there. So word of mouth is very important. And, of course, we try and build our profile as much as we can. We also organize a lot of events on campus, and a lot of students hear about us through our events. And, you know, at the RAGA Center, we have built very strong links with the community outside UBC. And we're very proud that we've brought a number of community activists into UBC as graduate students. They first became involved with the RAGA Center as volunteers. And then as they came to more of our events, they decided to come to UBC to do their graduate studies. So we're very proud that we've also been able to bring in students from the community who have a very strong record of community activism.
I actually wanted to ask you about RAGA because you are the mm-hmm. director of this center. So
yes.
can you go into sort of describing how it came to be and what you're currently doing?
Well, A colleague of mine, Dr. Valerie Raoul, initially set up the center as the SAGA Center, and that was for studies in autobiography, gender, and age. And Dr. Raoul was very interested in autobiography studies. Upon her retirement, you know, the center was offered to me, so I took on the directorship. And because my own interests are around race and gender and, you know, critical race feminist scholarship, you know, I kind of transformed the SAGA Center into the RAGA Center, and so race became part of the center's mandate. And our mandate really is to promote critical race feminist scholarship here at UBC and also in the larger community, and also to promote stronger links and dialogues between faculty of color and indigenous faculty and students. So, you know, I think it's very important that when we kind of under the rubric of race, we actually address all of the groups that are impacted by processes of racialization. And so for us, the priority has been to build links with indigenous scholars and students and activists, and also to promote critical race feminist studies, as I said.
That's fantastic. Now, the Center for Women's and Gender Studies has begun its weekly lecture series. So every Wednesday, there are these lectures that faculty, staff, students can attend. And last week, you gave a talk titled Slumdogs and Superstars,
yes.
Negotiating the Culture of Terror.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your lecture?
Well, you know, my lecture, it's a new project working on popular film. I mean, I was really affected by the film, as many people were when Slumdog opened. And, you know, I went to see the film, not knowing what to expect. And the film, I don't know if you remember, starts off with scenes of Jamal, who's the central character, being tortured by the police. And so immediately what came to mind to me was the debate around Americans using torture in the war on terror. Mm-hmm. And so immediately I thought, wow, you know, this is an interesting film. And then I was watching the Oscar ceremony where the film won the Best Film Award. And the music director was there, and he's Muslim. And, you know, he accepted the award, and he accepted the award with a comment that to me kind of referenced himself as a Muslim, an apologetic Muslim. And I thought, wow, you know, what is happening with this war on terror that somebody who is such a superstar begins by accepting an Oscar by apologizing for being a Muslim, essentially. And so I thought, wow, you know, I really want to see what this film is about and what are the politics, how does it intersect with the larger culture of the war on terror. And, you know, the film sparked off controversy, of course, in India, as well as in the UK, as well in the US and here in Canada. So I became really interested in what were the issues that were becoming issues. And what was interesting for me was that nobody had actually identified the film as a film about Muslims in India. So, you know, I became very intrigued, and I thought, okay, let's look at this film and see how it intersects with the ideology of the war on terror and how Muslims are represented, both in Western and non-Western contexts. So my paper was about that.
Fantastic. Now, what in other ways do you expand, right, you know, in terms of your research at the moment with this theme of the war on terror and the sort of intersections of gender?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my theoretical interests lie in the field of race, class, and gender. So intersectionality, social relations of race, class, and gender, how do they intersect? And so it's from that perspective that I've been looking at the war on terror. I'm looking at its ideology. I've looked at the role of the media in actually the kind of perpetuation of this ideology and what impact it is having on masculinities and femininities. So that's my larger project. What kinds of masculinities are emerging as kind of dominant through the war on terror? What kinds of femininities are being prescribed, and how do they affect not just Muslim women, but also non-Muslim women, American women, Canadian women? How do they kind of, you know, construct their own sense of who they are through this ideology of the war on terror? So that's what my research is currently looking at.
That's great. Now, you are also known as an intellectual activist.
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
Well, what that means to me is that theory and practice is integrally connected, you know, and I think we have a responsibility not just to understand the world, but also work towards changing it in a better direction. And so, you know, I mean, this is a point that feminists have been making for a very long time. And so I'm, you know, and I actually come from an activist tradition. I was an activist long before I became an academic. So I've really tried to balance the two together to make sure that theory and practice inform each other. And I guess that's what the label intellectual activist means. But it's a label that I wear very proudly. And I think more of us need to do that, because we know that there is no such thing as objective knowledge that has been largely discredited. And I guess what I get my students to think about is, why do we understand the world in particular kinds of ways? What are the interests that are vested in these understandings of the world? And how can we be actually producing forms of knowledge that are more liberatory, that have a much broader notion of social justice? And how do we actually make sure that the work that we do at UBC, in our research, in our teaching, wherever we are, actually helps us move towards that goal, the goal of social justice, which I think is desperately needed in the world right now. And so, you know, that's what makes me remain committed to both activism and intellectual work. Not that the two are mutually exclusive, but that, you know, there's a clearly activist component to the work that I do, which is committed to actually bringing about change in the world.
So what kind of work are you involved in outside of UBC? Can you give us examples of some of the community projects that you're part of?
Well, you know, before I came to UBC, I used to work for the National Action Committee on the Status of Women, which was then Canada's largest feminist organization. So I continue to work with some of those women's groups still. I also teach a practicum course where students are placed with community organizations as they take the course with me. They do volunteer work. And so we're always assessing this kind of theory-practice connection. So I do that through my course. Through the Raga Center, all of our activities are organized with a real emphasis on community engagement, meeting community needs, having community partners. So, you know, my advisory board is also made up of community representatives of community organizations. So, you know, I build that into the kind of work I do at Raga as well.
Now, if people want to get involved with any of these initiatives, how do they do that?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say was find out more about Raga, get on our listserv, make sure that you come to some of our events if you want a sense of what it is that we do there. So that's one way that people can get involved. At the Women's Studies Center, we also organize lots of events, the Wednesday lecture series, but we also have other events that we welcome students to come and join us. And most important, I think, take a course in women's studies. That's one way of finding out who we are and what we do and how we will kind of help transform how you see the world and your place in it. So, you know, my invitation to the students who are listening is come and take a course in women's studies.
What, Sinira, what made you first interested in studying this field?
In studying women's studies? Mm-hmm. Well, I guess my own experiences. And my own experience is not just as a woman, but as a racialized woman. So, you know, my first kind of activism was around third world support campaigns, really apartheid in South Africa. Like, that was an issue that I was active in before I joined a women's organization. There used to be an international organization called Third World First, and I used to belong to that before I ever joined a women's group. So it was really, you know, my own experience as an immigrant, of course, had, you know, widened my perspective on living in Western societies. So really kind of anti-poverty, third world exploitation, those were the first kinds of issues that I got involved about. Racism, the level of racism that existed in Western societies. So, and then from then on, of course, I went on to, you know, join women-only groups and kind of develop my feminist politics. So my politics have always been at the intersection of race and gender and class. And, you know, it was a very exciting way to understand the world better because it really, you know, it meant that you had no easy answers. You had no easy answers. You couldn't say that in any situation gender is always the primary kind of division because it isn't, right? It's much more complicated. And so it was very exciting coming to politics from that kind of understanding and that kind of grounded experience. So I guess what brought me to feminist politics, anti-racist politics, was life experience, seeing the world around me, learning more and more. And as you learn more and more with an open mind, I think you become more and more committed to the kind of activist scholarship that I really, scholarship of engagement is also what some people call it. And I think the more you learn about the world, I think the more interesting it becomes, the more complex it becomes, and the more you realize how little you know. And so I think it's a life experience thinking about things in a particular kind of way that is always committed to making the story more and more complex, to try and understand that there are many different experiences, many different points of view, many different perspectives, but at the heart of them always lies the question of power. Where is power located? And so, you know, that's what I'm always looking for in my own personal life, in my work life, as well as in my research interests.
What do you envision, Sanira, for the future of women's studies at UBC?
Well, I hope that women's studies keeps growing and expanding. I hope that it continues to open space for women whose concerns have been marginalized, both within feminist movements and also in women's studies as an intellectual discipline. I think there's a lot of work to be done because some of the most critical scholarship, some of the most important, urgent scholarship, actually even in women's studies exists on the margins. So I hope that women's studies can keep expanding but transforming itself in the process so that there's less room for co-optation of women's issues. So that's my hope for women's studies, is that it would keep transforming itself and actually, you know, not pushing away the voices that tend to get marginalized, which, you know, which kind of question how power is constituted within the community of women as well.
I know some scholars in women's studies have suggested they hope and envision the idea that women's studies or gender issues will be sort of in every taught in every classroom and in every discipline. There will be some, you know, representation, and that is already happening at many levels at the university. But I still think there needs to be more room in that area.
I think so, because even when it gets integrated into other disciplines, there's also dilution that takes place, and I'm always concerned about that because women's studies actually is taught from a kind of perspective that is feminist in its broadest sense, that for many of us is also anti-racist in its broadest sense. And there is a kind of critical edge to women's studies and its development and how we do it. So while I think it's good that it gets integrated into other disciplines, I would hate to see it lose that critical edge. And I think that danger is always there. And I would hate to see us get to a place where you have women's studies without women.
That's right. Now, what is your current research leading in towards of your next book? You've published a book already. You've been the editor of several, and you've published many articles. Can you give us a bit of an idea of where you're heading?
Yes. The book I'm working on right now is about the war on terror and the impact of this war, you know, on gender relations. So that is the big project. I hope to complete it. It's looking at issues like sovereignty. What does sovereignty mean in the 21st century? If we look at the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and how easily, you know, the quote-unquote international community accepted the destruction of these sovereign states, sovereign in whatever limited way they were. So I'm looking at questions of what sovereignty means, how that relates to processes of racialization, who has sovereignty, who doesn't. And at the level of the state, but also at the level of individuals. So if we look at what's happening to Muslims, for example, you know, their citizenship can be stripped away in a second with labeling them as kind of terrorist suspects, right? And so I'm thinking about what does sovereignty then mean at the level of the individual, right? What does citizenship mean for the Muslim men and women today? Where just an easy kind of labeling of suspicion, suspected terrorist, and you can be assassinated, you can be shipped off to Guantanamo Bay, you can be tortured. So what does it mean at the personal level as well, right? What does sovereignty mean then? Who becomes a sovereign subject? Who becomes a sovereign citizen whose rights the state will protect? And who's the kind of object that whose right the state will not protect? So I'm thinking through these questions, even though I'm talking about gender and representation, I'm thinking through sort of how power gets organized in the 21st century through questions like that. So I'm looking at masculinity and femininity, but in a very, very deep, grounded kind of way, trying to think through what these new kind of security states that are emerging, what do they mean for us? How are they changing our society for the foreseeable future? And I must say that the changes, from my perspective, are largely negative, and they're going to have consequences for a very long time, even long after the American troops withdraw from Afghanistan and Iraq, as they surely must one day. But the changes that are taking place in the name of the war on terror within Canadian society, within American society, as well as at the global level, I think are going to have really profound consequences, at least for our lifetime.
It sounds like your book is going to have a much broader audience, beyond women's studies.
Yes, I hope so. I think so.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Best of luck with writing that and
all
of your continuous work. You are a much admired person here at the university and also globally. And it was just been such a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your program.
This is Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Sunira Tobani from the Center for Women's and Gender Studies. For more details about her research, please visit www.wmst.ubc.ca. If you would like to hear an audio or video podcast of this show, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca. Now, I'd like to end today's show with some music by a fellow named Samit, who is a Ugandan musician who composed music for the film Taking Root, which honors a woman named Wangari Maathai, who was the Nobel Peace Prize winner who sparked an international movement for women's rights and in the environment by teaching poor Kenyan women to plant trees. Unfortunately, she died this past Sunday in a Nairobi hospital. So I'm going to leave you with that music. I am Farha Khan. Thank you very much for listening today.
Piara, piara, piba, piara, piara, piba, piara, piara, yangu ni yako mama, yangu ni yetu, yetu ni yako zata, yetu ni yako. Piara, 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 piara. piara, piara. Yangoni yako papa. Yangoni yetu. Yetu ni yako bambi. Yangoni yetu. Piara, piara.
Wait, hold on, are we rolling?
Blame it on the snow. Blame it on the snow.
I was driving home early Sunday morning through Bakersfield, listening to gospel music.
Brothers and sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution.
Bobby the Badger Ferris here. You know what your week's been missing?
Start up the computer. You could just listen to the rock and roll nation.
Hank's giving me those high tides. High cash is gonna sing it low.
Tune into the Barn Burner late Thursday afternoons from 5 till 6 p.m.
I think that's called the drive time.
Thanks, Bubbles. The Barn Burner on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver for your weekly fix of
honky tonk heroes
and
would it kill you every once in a while to play a little fog hat?